Thanks for coming. Appreciate it. I'm going to tell you a little story. I think we're starting, right? Okay, good. A little while ago, I was Googling myself on the up on the internet, and this thing kept popping up over and over again. This Sid Meier says, games are a series of interesting decisions, and some people felt that was the most brilliant statement ever made in terms of games, and some people felt, Sid Meier, what an idiot, that's totally wrong, that's nothing. And I realized this was based on something I believe I said at a GDC presentation way back in the early days of computer games. And I had never really thought too much about it, but it had kind of caught on with people writing books about games and trying to find fun and things like that. And I thought it might be interesting to kind of dig a little deeper into that idea and talk about interesting decisions and how I think it's a useful way of looking at games, and maybe some ways that might be useful for other game designers. And I'm going to try not to talk about any specific genre of game or type of game, but talk more about decisions in general and how perhaps we can make them more interesting, how we can recognize them, and things like that. Up until today, really the only way that I've kind of talked about this idea is by breaking down the statement to series, and I think that speaks to the idea of pacing, that games have a pace to them. I think we all recognize, if we look at it, that certain games are very fast-paced, certain games are slower-paced, and that has an impact on the quality of the decisions and the nature of the decisions. And the other part is the idea of interesting decisions. And what makes a decision interesting? It's kind of almost easier to look at it at what is not an interesting decision. For example, if in a game you're presented with choice A, B, and C, and the player always chooses A, you probably haven't created an interesting decision for the player, and the computer should just choose A automatically and move on. Again, if you present the player with a choice of A, B, and C, and the player kind of randomly just chooses one of those and moves on, again, you probably haven't provided the player with an interesting decision. So that's just kind of a very first level look at that idea, but what we want to do today, I think, is dig a little deeper into the idea and try and talk about how we can make our decisions more interesting and make our games more fun. Now, I've gotten some pushback on this idea, people who disagree with the idea of that games are a series of interesting decisions. And I'm not going to argue about that today. I don't claim this is the only way of looking at games or applies to every single game. I think if you have, you know, a rhythm game like Guitar Hero, I could make a case that there are fascinating decisions in there. But it's not a game where interesting decisions are front and center. Also, if a puzzle game, for example. So there may be some types of games for which the idea of interesting decisions is not a super useful way of looking at them. But I think for the majority of games, it is useful to look at them in terms of the decisions that the player is presented with and how interesting they are. So how do we use this this idea of interesting decisions? This is a picture of my son and I playing a computer game. To give you a sense of time, he's now a college graduate. So this was a little while ago, but it kind of encapsulates for me what we're trying to do here, why it is important that we make our games fun, that we find the fun, that we search for the fun and make them as fun to play as possible to kind of generate these moments for the player. And I think that thinking about interesting decisions is one way of finding the fun. So when is this idea useful? I think it's a useful concept during the design phase. One of the things that I see often is designs are kind of about putting together pieces of other games. You know, what if we took a little bit of a shooter and added some StarCraft to it, and then we put in, you know, maybe some racing or whatever. Kind of Lego game design. You know, the idea that, well, these other games are fun, so if I take pieces of these games, my game is itself going to be fun. Unfortunately, that doesn't always work out. And I think it's a more useful way to look at a new game design in terms of what are the decisions that I'm presenting the player with. Are they interesting? You know, put yourself in the player's point of view, in the player's chair, and imagining what decisions can I create based on this scenario, this design, this world that I want to create. So I think it's a useful concept to apply, even in the early design stages, is to kind of imagine what are the actual decisions that the player is being asked to make during the course of the game. And I think this can help you to kind of crystallize what are the cool parts of this design idea that you have and what to kind of focus your early prototyping on. And I'm sure we all believe in rapid prototyping. That's a whole other talk. The idea of focusing on interesting decisions can be useful during the development phase as you're making a game. How do I make this game more fun? One of the key ways to do that is to look at the decisions that the player is making during the game and try to make them more interesting. Now, we'll talk more about what interesting means a little later. But again, during the development of the game, it's very useful to look at your decisions and see how the players respond to them and how interesting they are. It's also a useful concept as you're debugging the game. Where is the fun? I think we've all been near the end of the project. Every project of ours has what we call the Valley of Doom. About halfway to two-thirds of the way through, you're kind of convinced, why did we ever make this game? This is never going to work. This is not fun enough. I think focusing again on your decisions and trying to make them as interesting as fun as possible is something that's worth doing even during the later stages of the game. If you're trying to find and refine those last few ounces of fun, I think some of the ideas that we're going to talk about can be very useful for doing that. So what are some of the characteristics of interesting decisions? I think a very common one is they involve some sort of a trade-off. You can buy a big sword, but it costs you 500 gold. I'm playing a racing game, I can choose this car, which is very fast, but doesn't have great handling, or I can choose this other car, has great handling, but it's not quite as fast. In a civilization game, I can build a defensive unit and defend my city, but then I'm not generating more gold, or I can build a building that'll help my civilization advance, or again, there's all these most interesting decisions, I'd almost say all of them, involve some sort of a trade-off, and it's just important to recognize what that trade-off is when you look at your decisions. And good decisions, I think, are situational. I think this is a very key idea that when the decision is presented to the player, ideally it interacts in some very interesting way with the game situation. For example, we talked about the fast car versus the car with good handling. Well, that is going to interact with what the next race is. What does that track look like? What are your particular skills as a driver? What are you trying to accomplish in this race? If you're playing a shooter, a trade-off might be between sneaking around and hiding behind cover or rushing forward. In Civ, I think there are many, many decisions that are really situational. I haven't explored much of the map yet, so I want a fast unit. I want a scout unit to run around and see what's out there. I'm just about to be attacked by Genghis Khan and his horde of Mongols, so I need defensive units. I just discovered a new territory. I want to plant a city over there. I need to build some settlers. So it's one decision that the player is faced with. What do I build next? But it ties very directly into the game situation. And that's how you really add interest and variety to a lot of decisions, is by making them very situational, very, very dependent on the current game situation. Some decisions can be personal. In other words, tied to your gaming style. Perhaps you are cautious, turtle, you enjoy the turtle strategy, And so you would build defensive units. You would build a very secure base from which you can then expand. Perhaps you're aggressive. You would build a whole different set of units. You'd have a whole different strategy. And again, the decision, this interesting decision, would allow you to express your personal play style. Decisions have persistence. Interesting decisions have persistence. They affect the game for a certain amount of time. Maybe it's a long period of time, maybe it's a short period of time. But you really want to be aware of what the persistence of a decision is. If it's a long-term decision, you really need to give the player enough information to feel comfortable making that decision. There's nothing worse than playing a game, doing something very early on that you didn't quite understand that totally messes up your play experience for the rest of the game. So it's important to understand what the persistence of your decisions are and present them in a way appropriate to that. If a decision has a short persistence, it only affects the game for the next minute or two, you can be a little more, take more chances, maybe provide a lot of interesting options where the player realizes, I'm just kind of going to try this out. It's not going to mess up my game forever, but I might try this new strategy or something different. So consider the persistence of the decisions when presenting them to the player. Here are some types of decisions. Often, you might be looking at your game and saying, I need more decisions. You know, I need to put some more stuff in there. It just doesn't feel like there's enough going on. I'm not giving the player enough stuff to do. So here are some of the types of decisions you might look at, see if there are opportunities to include these in your game. One of the classic decision types is risk versus reward. In a game like Civilization, it would be, do I defend my first city with a couple of phalanxes and then be kind of cautiously explore, or am I going to just kind of build a couple of scouts and just check everything out, and hopefully the barbarians won't show up, but if they do, darn. Might be choosing the fast car in a racing game. You know, I'm going to go as fast as I can and just hope I can make it around those curves, you know. So often there are decisions that involve this idea of risk versus reward. I can take a greater risk with the potential of a greater reward, but if it doesn't work out, then the penalties are larger. So this is one type of decision you might want to look at in your game. Is there an opportunity for finding some risk versus reward decisions? I think in almost any kind of game, you'll find these kind of opportunities for these decisions. Short-term versus long-term is another category of decision that you probably can find in your game design. In Civilization, again, building a wonder, which is something that's going to take a long time, but in the long term, it's going to do something wonderful for your civilization, versus building a chariot, which is going to be cool right away. It's going to be a lot of fun, but it might not have the same long-term impact on your game. In a racing game, you know, perhaps buying that new car, it's going to take you a while to tune it up to maximum capacity, but in the long term, it's going to be a good investment for your racing career. Short-term decision might be to add some new tires or a bigger engine to your current car, which is going to help you in the short term, but a longer term, you still have to drive that same car. So look for opportunities to include short versus long-term decisions in your game. Again, the idea of accommodating the player's play style. What we found in development is you really can't do enough of this. It's very tempting as a designer to imagine that everybody plays the game the same way that you do, and it's very tempting as a design and development group to kind of feel that you represent all players. But there's an incredible range of players out there, and it's increasing as games become more and more popular and more widespread. So try and include as many varieties of play style as you can in the decisions that you provide the players. We're now up to, I think, 7 difficulty levels in Civilization to accommodate an incredibly wide range of players. Again, defensive versus offensive, aggressive versus cautious, all these different play styles are things that you want to provide opportunities for the player to express as they play your game. think about at what level your decisions are. I'm sorry that I keep coming back to Civilization, but it's a game that I'm somewhat familiar with. I think one of the strengths of Civilization is that it has things happening at various levels. There are things happening that are short-term. You're attacking a city that's close to you. You're defending this other city against the barbarians. You're exploring the coastline to see what's happening out there. You have some medium-term things going on. You've decided that you're going to go for a military strategy. So your decisions are in the medium term are geared to conquering, exploring, expanding your territory. Your long-term strategy, your long-term goal is to win the game. Your medium-term strategy might not work out. You might need to change your strategy halfway through the game or whatever. Long-term, you have the idea of winning the game. You might be going for a high score. You might be you have a goal that extends even outside of this particular game that you're playing. In a lot of game styles, types, you really need to include metagaming in your long-term decision-making. In other words, am I trying to get a high ranking? Am I playing a multiplayer game where my clan is really counting on me? Or there are things that are happening even outside of one play game that are goals that the player has. And a game that has decisions at these various levels, I think, has, it's kind of one of the keys to the one more turn quality of a game like Civilization, or any game that is really draws a player in, is going to have things happening at various levels. So there's never a point where you're kind of all done with everything that you're trying to do. You might achieve one of your short-term goals, but you're in the middle of one of your medium-term goals, and your long-term goal is still out there. And as you develop a new short-term goal, maybe you achieve your medium-term goal, but there's always something that you're looking forward to, something that is coming up that's important to you as a player. And the more you can get the player kind of thinking into the future, thinking about what am I going to do next, what are my plans, I think that's what's compelling, what creates the one more turn, or the one more race, or the one more battle, or whatever, one more of whatever you have in your game. You want the player to kind of always be looking forward to that one more. Another type of decision that might not sound like it falls into the same category as some of these other ones, but is actually pretty important to the player, is the idea of customizing, investing the player. If you're playing a racing game, for example, just picking the color of your car. It seems fairly straightforward, but that gives the player an investment in, they made a decision that invests them in the game. In Civilization, you can name your cities. Doesn't really affect the play of the game, but it's a decision that the player makes that makes them more connected to this particular game that they're playing. In a role-playing game, you might be able to choose the gender of your hero or different characteristics, dress them in different ways, whatever. Think about ways of investing the player in your game by inviting them to make decisions that let them express their personality or their gaming style. So those are some different types of decisions that I think it's worth looking at your game and trying to find ways to include in them. Now, when you present these decisions, it's really important how they're presented and how you respond to them. And we'll talk about that for just a second. What information does the player have as they're about to make a decision? And it's very easy for us as designers who've played the game hundreds of times to assume the player knows everything that we know when we get to this point. And that's a very dangerous assumption. It's probably one of the most common problems I see with games in development, is that you assume the player knows this or that or whatever, and you give the player this decision where they feel kind of totally lost, and they're they make it, and then they feel very uncomfortable about making it, and then they keep, you know, it's a kind of a gnaws at you. You know, if you made a decision and you're not really sure why, whether it's the right one or you know what the impact of it is, it kind of really hurts your game playing experience. So I think it's worth almost erring on the side of presenting the player with too much information, or at least enough that they feel that they're comfortable with understanding what the choice is that you're giving the player. We have found that you want to manage the number of decisions. I think early on in some of our sieve designs, you were faced with choosing from among 7 or 9 or 12 different technologies you could research. And we really found that players have a tolerance for a smaller number of, I think 3, 5 is a kind of a comfortable number to choose from. But just be aware that it's pretty easy to overwhelm players at this point. So especially early in the game, you want them to feel that they're kind of going down. If they choose the default or they choose what the advisor is recommending, it's probably not such a bad decision. So be sure there's enough information there when the decision is presented to the player. Another thing to be really aware of is that there's a learning curve to playing your games that ties into how much information the player needs to be presented early on. And as the players get better, as you get better in your playing the game, your expectations for what you need to know to make an informed decision will change. So what we do almost from the beginning of our development is to try and introduce our game to new players and understand what the game feels like at the very early part of the learning curve. We have some friends in terms of kind of making players comfortable and enjoying our decisions, and we call them genre conventions. In other words, things that you know from having played other games in this genre. Very helpful in terms of the interface conventions, for example. If you're playing a shooter, you can understand which button does what, and what when you move the joystick this way, this is what's supposed to happen. By, for goodness sake, use those genre conventions. There's nothing more disconcerting than having the wrong thing happen when you press a button that in every other game does X. But just satisfying the genre conventions is not really enough to make a new game. So that's why I suggest you take advantage of all those conventions out there to make the game very comfortable to your player, but then do more. Add something new, a new button that does something cool, a new feature. But be sure and take advantage of these conventions because they will make the player feel very, very comfortable in your world. And again, start thinking in the future about what they want to do as opposed to thinking about the present and how does this game actually work. It's one of the reasons that a lot of our games involve historical topics is because the player can bring to a historical topic a lot of information that they kind of already know. And it's important to reinforce that information for the player. If they run into Genghis Khan in a civilization game, he's going to be kind of angry and aggressive. You know, I think that makes the player feel, I kind of get where he's coming from. You know, you don't have to explain it in a massive civilopedia. Or Gandhi, you know, he's got his own personality. So, or if you're building a game about railroads or pirates, there's a lot that the player can bring to a topic like that that they already know. And all you need to do really design-wise is to kind of reinforce a little bit of that. And, you know, if there's an evil Spaniard and a beautiful governor's daughter and a few things like that, you understand that this is the world that's being created for you and you can kind of go forward. That's not only true of historical games, but we have a world where sci-fi games have their own set of conventions. And it's important that you understand them and make the player feel comfortable in that world. Now, if you want to break a few or change it up a little bit, you know, that's fine, but make sure the player understands where that you're doing that and that this is the cool part of your game, but this doesn't destroy, make all the other decisions in the game ones where they kind of have to figure out on their own what the world is like. And so one of the reasons I love zombies is they're very clear. The motivation of zombies is clear. Very little explanation has to happen to the player. You know, zombies have their problems, and it's very clear how you need to solve those problems. So it's kind of an example of a decision that doesn't have to you don't have to add a lot of information to the player. They pretty much know what to do. And so it's a very clear, setting up a decision like that is very clear. On the other hand, once the player's made a decision, it's very, very important how you respond to this decision. And it's another place where a lot of times we've kind of fall down. And then the worst thing you can do is basically just move on. There's nothing more paranoia-inducing than having made a decision and the game just kind of goes on. And you at least give a sound effect or something to indicate that, yes, I heard what you said, and I'm going to do it. You know, ideally, the more you can respond, the better. We found in Civ Revolution that players were just so happy to get this feedback from. A lot of times, you'd be talking to a leader of another civilization, and you'd be negotiating about war, peace, or trading things. But they would make these kind of aside comments like, you know, I notice you moved your phalanx next to my city over there. You know, what's up with that? Or that unit you have has won 5 battles, you know, in a row. That's really cool. Or they really started to interact with you as a player and give you almost more feedback than necessary. But it's very important that you respond to the player as they make a decision in a way that, one, they understand that you heard them and you're moving on. But you can actually build on that to suggest different things. Like, okay, you know, you chose that option, that could work, but, you know, if you'd done this, maybe this might have happened. Or, fine, you know, attack me, you know, but we could have been friends and I would have given you some technology or whatever. So you can introduce into your response to the player some ideas about other courses of action that they could take or what they might do the next time they play the game. So responding to the player's decision is a time to really think about how you do that and make it a kind of a rewarding experience. It kind of comes down to the does anybody know I'm here factor. Basically, if you're playing a single-player game, you are imagining yourself as the leader of a great civilization or a super-duper race car driver or science fiction fantasy hero with huge bulging muscles. But you're really just sitting there in front of your computer in your lonely room with the glow from the monitor on your face. And it's really important to let the player know that you know that they're there, that you know that they're playing, that you're a partner with them. You're right there next to them all the way. And you are the leader of a great civilization, or yes, you are a fantastic race car driver, or yes, your muscles are super bulging. And the response that you give to the player's decisions is really the tool that you have to do that. Whether it's a sound, a text, visual, a graphic, you know, think of the tools that you have to kind of really reinforce what the player, the fantasy that the player is creating in their mind, and really allow them to enjoy that. So, what I hope is part of your design process is what I'm calling a decision feedback loop. In other words, that you're constantly iterating on your design, and those ideas that you get from your players, et cetera, are being tried out. And I mean, it's really can't recommend enough the idea of having a tight iteration loop on your game design and having as many people play it as possible, and try and feed that information back into your design. The more times you can go around that loop, I think the better your game is going to be. So it's really, I think, important to try and structure your technology or design process to allow that kind of iteration. So hopefully you're listening to a lot of players and getting a lot of feedback. Obviously you can't do everything. Some ideas might be good or bad, but the more ideas that you are able to kind of process, I think the better your game will be. It is useful to kind of understand the different kinds of players that you will be dealing with and talking to as you kind of expose your game to your playtesters and your friends and your co-workers or whoever you are able to get to test your game. you're going to get a lot of different kinds of response. And it's really up to you as a designer to filter that and decide what is really going to help my game, what is going to make it better, or what is going, what's an interesting idea but doesn't fit this game, or is not going to work. So it's kind of useful to know a little bit about the types of players that you'll probably start to get some feedback from. The first player is Mr. Kickbutt here. And I'm not going to ask you to raise your hand, but some of you may recognize yourself in this player. This is the player who only cares about winning the game. If they won the game, it's great, it's awesome, it's the best game ever. If they didn't win, then your game stinks and really, you should try something else. So this player's input is useful in terms of especially maybe tuning some of the higher levels, the more advanced difficulty levels of the game, and getting a sense of kind of those issues. But you kind of need to be careful, because a lot of times tuning of difficulty levels and things like that really doesn't come together till late in the game. And it can be kind of discouraging to hear from Mr. Kickbutt that your game was too easy or too hard or just. So be aware that some players, their focus is really on winning the game, and their input just has to be kind of filtered that way. There's Ms. Genre. It's another type of player that you may get some input from. And again, it can be very useful. This is a player that loves this specific genre, whether it's a first-person shooter or a real-time strategy or role-playing. And if your game fits exactly in that genre, this player will love it, because it's like the games that they love. If there's any deviations from the conventions or the standards of your genre, they will complain. It's in World of Warcraft, they did this, and you're doing that. That's not right. Again, that's useful for understanding whether you're using the genre conventions, but hopefully you're trying a few new things, and Ms. Genre here is not going to be too happy if you stretch outside of the genre conventions. We have Mr. Minmax. This is another kind of player. Again, there may be a few of you out there. I don't know. We'll have some intervention sessions after to kind of help you break out of this mold. But Mr. Minmax is basically someone who really needs to understand every algorithm and how to squeeze every last decimal point of advantage out of everything that can be done in the game. Again, a very useful point of view, but not the way everybody plays. So kind of filter this input. The very useful way to maybe understand whether some of your algorithms are not balanced, etc. But Mr. Minmax is out there kind of really trying to unravel, reverse engineer your game and figure out exactly what's happening and use that to his advantage. We have Ms. Paranoid. This is a player, you've probably run into them, that is convinced that the computer is cheating on them, knows exactly what they're trying to do, and is foiling them at every opportunity. If there's a random number die roll in the game, it always goes against them. And just kind of has this paranoid approach to your game. I spoke a little bit in one of my other talks about Civ Revolution and how we actually ended up adjusting some of the die rolls and making sure that two bad things didn't happen in a row, for example, and things that would kind of trigger the paranoid response in Ms. Paranoid. So these are all viewpoints that are worth listening to, but in each case, probably can't use all of these players' ideas, but it's useful to understand where these players are coming from and what their reactions might be to your game. There's Mr. History. Mr. History is going to tell you, wait a minute, the 24th Michigan didn't arrive on the battlefield at Gettysburg until 10:30. You've got them coming in at 10:15, or this didn't really happen, or this didn't, again, interesting, useful input, but maybe not what you're basing the most important thing to your game. So Mr. History is going to give you some good background, et cetera, but not every player out there is going to be a Mr. History, so you want you really want to appeal to somewhat a broader audience. There's Mr. Bubble Boy. This is a player that will remember the one moment in your game when something bad happened to them. They could be having a wonderful experience, but if just at one point they had a setback or something unfortunate happened, that's really what that was their game experience for them. And I think it's really, you need to present setbacks in a very sensitive way where the player understands why it happened, what they can do next time to prevent it from happening or go in a different direction. But you may have some players where one incident in your game kind of colors their entire experience. Oh. And again, these are things that you'll fix, that you'll tune out, that as you develop, that will get fixed. But if this player's input to you is totally derived from that one experience, then you kind of have to filter that out. And then there's Mr. Designer. This is another kind of player that you'll get feedback from. It's basically, they have another game in mind, which they wish you were making. And all of their input is kind of like why your game isn't their game, or why your game isn't like the game that they are wanting you to make. So that's, you know, there could be, again, some valuable input. Maybe you want to use a little bit of their idea, but just be aware that they're kind of trying to get you to design their game and not the game that you're making. Okay, so we've got a game that we're working on, and it's cool, it's pretty good, it's fun, kind of fun, but how do we make it better? How do we take the decisions that we have and make them even more interesting? The first thing that we look at, I think, is often just the balance of the decisions. A lot of times, just simply fixing the balance is going to help your decisions to be, make your decisions a lot more interesting. We talked at the very beginning about how most decisions involve some sort of trade-off. You know, I'm going to buy a sword, but it's going to cost me 300 gold. You may find that nobody's buying that sword. Well, that might be an indication that it should cost 200 gold. Or you may find that everybody is walking around with one of these $300 swords. Maybe it should be $500. So one of the early things to look at is just, is it simply a balance issue? That my decision would be more interesting with a different sort of balance attached to it. Again, it can apply to any, if you have a racing game, you know, those cool tires are too expensive or too cheap, et cetera. Another way of making your decisions more interesting, I think, is to make them more important. Again, we're kind of talking in very kind of abstract terms, but your game is about something. It's about something cool. It's about something neat. Make the decision tie more directly and coolly into what your game is about. Make it more significant. Make the sword shiny and have a Sharpie edge made out of titanium or something. You know, find ways to bring your game fantasy back into the decisions to make them feel more important. Again, in Civilization, talking to the other leaders gives the decisions that you make there and the interaction that you have feel more important. I mean, those could be simple check boxes, you know, but having the other leader there animated and talking to you gives those kind of decisions a feeling of greater importance. Whatever your game is about, feed more of that directly into your decision-making, and I think it'll feel more important and have more character. Control the amount of information that the player has when they're making the decisions. Again, coming back to Civilization, we have a system where the world is gradually revealed. And that really affects a lot of the decisions that the player makes. Imagine a Civ game where the entire map was revealed at the very beginning. I mean, that would be a very different game experience. And so by managing the amount of information that the player has, you can make your decisions more interesting. In other situations, giving the player more information might be the way of making that decision more more interesting. If they knew more about what was going on in the rest of the world, they might feel better and find the decisions to be more interesting. So look at the amount of information that the player has as they look at the decisions, and see if either giving them more information or less information would be a way to make that particular decision more interesting. The number of choices you give the player. As designers, you know, we think we get paid by the decision, by the choice. You know, the more choices we give the player, the better designers we are, and the more we ought to get paid. Be careful of that philosophy, because the player is easily overwhelmed, and you may find that by managing the number of choices that you give the player, you actually make the decision more interesting, often by kind of cutting them down, or maybe combining two or three together, things like that. Look at the number of decisions that you're providing the player to see if it might not be more interesting if you did it a little differently. Making them more flavorful. This is really a presentation issue. You know, a lot of times designers, we think we could design a game text only with programmer graphics and it would be totally cool. Well, that's fine, but take advantage of those artists, those writers, those sound guys, all those other people that are working on your project to add more flavor and interest and excitement to your decisions. Again, coming back to civilization, interacting directly with the great leaders. In a racing game, you know, as you add stuff to your car, it rotates around and light shines on it, and cool stuff happens with your hero. You see the new equipment being put on them, and they smile, and you find ways to just add that kind of game flavor to your decisions, and that's another way of making them more interesting. Look at how much time you're giving the player to make a decision. It's really key to understand that most genres are almost defined by the amount of time you give the player. It may seem like a minor issue, but if you change the amount of time that you give the player to make decisions, you're almost stepping into a new genre. If you're playing Civilization, which is turn-based, you make it real-time. All of a sudden, you're playing a game like Age of Empires or RTS. If you're playing a shooter and it's moving very quickly and you slow down the time frame, all of a sudden you're playing a sneaking around game and a whole different feeling. So by looking at the amount of time you're giving the player to make decisions, you're almost defining what genre you're in. And do you want to slide your game a little more in one direction, genre direction, or another? And there's also basically an inverse relationship between how long you give the player to make a decision and how deep and complex that decision is going to be. You have to be careful to manage that balance. If you're playing a game with very complicated decisions that come at you one after the other, the player is basically going to feel overwhelmed and out of control, never having a chance to look forward and anticipate what they're going to do next, but always trying to figure out what's going on right now. On the other hand, if you give the player some very simple decisions at a very slow pace, they're kind of bored. That's a boring game. I won't mention any names, but. And the last way to make a decision more interesting is to get rid of it. If you've tried all these things and they don't work, maybe the decision just is not one that should you should take out of your game. Be ruthless in terms of cutting things out. Generally, we find that probably a third of the things that we try, if not more, eventually end up getting taken out of the game because they just aren't fun and interesting enough. So again, as designers, we don't get paid by the decision. We get paid by how good our game's at the end of the day, and it may be the best decision to get rid of your whatever's not working. So we've talked about kind of, in theoretical terms, all these different ways of looking at your decisions, perhaps making them more interesting, finding ways to kind of maximize the decision-making process of your game. But really, I don't want to forget that your game is more than just decisions. I think once you've got the game working and you've got all these cool decisions in there, and the players are you've really kind of tuned that part of the game, you need to remystify your game. Really, make it about the fantasy that you're trying to create for the player. It's the combination of this wonderful fantasy world that you create and the interesting decisions that the player gets to make in that world that really is the sum total of the quality of your game. So we want you to maximize the awesomeness of your game world, of the graphics, of the way that you present it. These are all very important tools that augment these decisions that you have to make the game maximally awesome. And we encourage you to make it epic. Again, this is we're inviting the player to step into your designed world and become some awesome character. And we're fulfilling this fantasy for us to kind of step out of our humdrum lives and become great heroes. And so I don't want to, by focusing on all the kind of minutiae of making decisions and how to make them better, lose sight of the story that you're telling, the world that you're inviting the player to step into, and the ways that you can really tie your decisions to reinforcing that world, creating that world in the player's mind. I think that's the best of all worlds is where you've imagined this incredible world that's going to be a great place to inhabit and live and explore. And then by the way you present decisions to the player, you've got their imagination totally hooked into that world, and they're thinking about all the possibilities and what they're going to do next and what's going to happen as they wander through your world. So the two really reinforce each other. I think if you present a really awesome fantasy to the player, they're going to jump in there. And once they get in there, if they've got cool things to do, cool decisions to make, and ways that they think about replayability. Next time I play this game, I'm going to do this. Different ways to win, different paths through the game. If you can present that, all those things to them in terms of decisions that they make, you've really got a huge win there by combining this awesome world that you've created with these great decisions that the player makes while they're in there. So that concludes this dissertation on interesting decisions. I appreciate your indulgence. We do have... We do have a little time for questions if there are any questions. Yes. A Pirates fan. Oh, I guess we're going to line up at the microphones.
So on those lines, what was the key decision in making it or never offering a multiplayer experience for Pirates?
A multiplayer experience in Pirates? Multiplayer is actually tough. I think the thing that we look at first is symmetry versus asymmetry. In a game like Civilization or Age of Empires or many others, there are multiple similar actors in the game. And those kind of games are easy to make into multiplayer. In a single player, the AI takes over some of those actors. In multiplayer, everybody takes over one. In a game like Pirates or many others, there's kind of one hero, and the world revolves around what that one hero does. And that's a difficult situation to... You know, there's only room in this world for one hero, and so that it would require just a very significant game redesign to make Pirates a multiplayer game, for example.
Okay, thanks.
Move over here.
Okay. My question is, one thing I notice in a lot of strategy games is that an interesting decision over time can become mundane or monotonous, like building a... your units in one city, like in the first few turns, is interesting, but when you're like 200, 300 turns in, you got 12 different cities, 12 different new production structures, it just becomes mundane. Is there a way to combat that, or is it just an eventuality with decisions?
I think there's definitely a way to combat that. I mean, you have to, you're basically dealing with a problem which you have in many games, is you want the player to feel that they're advancing and moving forward and things are getting bigger and larger and whatever, mm-hmm. without getting more complicated or more micromanagey or et cetera. So I think there are a couple of tools that you can use. One that we use sometimes in Civilization is making, as your capabilities to build things grows, the things that you build get bigger and more expensive, but cooler, you know, in exchange for that, so that you're building, as your capability to build grows, you're exposed to things that are more expensive but more cool, so that the total number of things that you're working on or building kind of stays somewhat constant. As the world grows, you get units that move quicker. So, again, it takes the same relative amount of time to get from one side of the world to the other. I think it's definitely an issue, but I think there are design techniques that you can use to address some of those concerns.
Thank you.
Yes.
Hi. I found economic theory to be quite interesting when I'm designing decisions, you know, stuff like opportunity cost. And I was wondering if that's something that you've looked at or that you use.
I think yes, in terms of in a general sense, economics is probably a very interesting way to look at almost any game situation in terms of the trade-offs involved and the costs. We don't have an economist on staff that kind of makes sure we've got everything exactly right. I think it's one of those situations where with some kind of basic concepts, you can get things feeling right. But the idea of trade-offs and opportunity costs and you know, investing for the future, I think those are all kind of fundamental ideas that are pretty intuitive to players. I think that's the other thing, that we want to use those economic concepts that are intuitive to players, not try and, you know, require you to be a PhD in economics to play the games. But most of us understand that the idea of costs and getting a good deal and that short-term versus long-term kind of things.
Thanks.
Yes.
Hi, great talk. Really appreciate it. My question is kind of two parts. One, what processes or tools do you use to measure, because games like Civ, you have a lot of people playing, they make a lot of decisions. What do you use to measure the feedback and how you change your game based on that? And do you ever tailor your... do you ever tailor for the player the number of decisions you present to them? So a support player doesn't like the massive, overwhelming number of decisions, but a min-max player would probably love that. So do you look at the personality types, try to figure out who they are, and tailor the experience for them?
Yeah, I'll answer the first part second part first. There are ways to address different player types. I mean, in Civ, the most obvious ones are difficulty levels, and the size of the map. I mean, you can, by changing the size of the map, you can control, you know, do I have a super long, complicated game or a simpler game? And in terms of the feedback that we get from players, a lot of it initially is just us playing, but we, as the game gets more playable and kind of more fleshed out, we expand that circle to bring as many players in as we can. But one thing I didn't mention, but I think it is important that... not everybody can play kind of a half-fixed, half-working, half-broken game and kind of imagine what it might feel like when it's actually working. And those are the testers. Those are the people who generate feedback that are really the most useful. Who can kind of say, well, you know, this was broken, but I can imagine when it's working, this would have been cool, or I was able to get around that. You know, some of your testers will be able to do that, and they're going to give you some very valuable input earlier in the process. At the end, you kind of want people who are will complain about everything, because your game needs to be perfect at that point of view. So you want to bring those cranky people back again and sit them down in front of your game and say, now play it. And, you know, is there anything that's bugging you about this?
Thanks.
Yes.
Sometimes, especially in some specific genres, you have to balance actual decisions versus the illusion of decisions. How do you achieve that balance?
Illusion is your friend in game design. I mean, games are essentially an illusion. So I think that we talked a little bit about making them flavorful, or the more of your game world that you can bring into the decision-making process, You know, I think you kind of have to stay in character a lot of times in game design. And yes, you are the king of a great civilization or this incredible superhero, or, you know, I think that it's important for the game to stay in character to help the player retain that suspension of disbelief and allow them to continue to believe that they're in there. And I think that the idea of illusion, we're constantly amazed by what people think is in the game. That's not really there, but you know, if you present a consistent game world with some interesting decisions, the player's imagination will fill in. You know, I know Genghis Khan doesn't like me. You know, he's probably talking to those other leaders about me when I'm not, you know, I'm not there, or you know, whatever it is. I think if you provide enough hooks for the player to jump into your world, they'll fill in a lot more with their own imagination. Yeah.
Hi. I wanted to know how many iterations you actually do when you're making the decisions, because some of the decisions you presented you make really early in the stages of development, and later changing them it's getting really difficult. So either it's only your own team, or do you get a special interest group to do the early testing?
We're pretty brutal about ripping out decisions and putting in different ones. There's a classic story with a game called Colonization, which we did in the 90s, I guess, where about 2 weeks before we shipped it, we changed the radius of cities from two squares to one square, which was kind of a totally radical change, but it just had to be done. So we try not to get wedded to decisions that things that we put in early on and are pretty brutal about ripping them out and trying something different. On the other hand, you know, a lot of times it's kind of intuition, or hopefully you make a lot of the right guesses early on that'll help your game. And the other thing we do is we actually don't make games. If we're halfway through the game, you know, a classic story is our dinosaur game. We tried and tried and tried to make that game, just wasn't working, and so we didn't end up making it. So, you know, I think it doesn't always work out, and I think you have to be kind of painfully honest about what's happening in your game, and be willing to change it up, or even have to move on to something else.
Okay, thanks.
Yes. When you're making a game that is very long, like several hours for a particular game, how do you deal with getting fast iteration? If you're making a change really late in the tech tree or somewhere that you really have to play through like 5 hours to even, you know, be able to test if this, not mm-hmm. only if it is a good game design, but if it even works. How do you set up so that you get a reasonable iteration time for problems like that?
Well, you spend a lot of time playing. I think, yeah, and when I'm developing, I'm probably spending over half my time just playing the game and getting my own personal feedback. Save games are very, very useful. You know, if you save the game halfway through or three quarters of the way through and pick it up at a later time. One of the things that we build into our prototypes is constant auto-saves so that we can always go back. If something happens, we can always go back to a previous time, or if we want to, you know, try to look at a change and see how it affects the game, we can find a save where we can kind of get very quickly to that. So it's kind of about building your methodology around the idea of rapid prototyping and that kind of thing. I think we have time maybe for one more question.
Oh, okay. So, I was going to ask you a question about, well, it's not really a trend. I just noticed more games, they've decided to try to consolidate actions together so that when you do one thing, it does like two different things at once, or else they try to limit the number of actions you can do per turn. Like I think Skulls of the Shogun and Hero Academy kind of does that. And I was really glad to see that that was actually one of the things you pointed out in the interesting decision slide. So I was glad to see that was something that. So, have you played any, do you know of any games that kind of use that really well? I think maybe chess might be a good example. Do you have any other, maybe modern games examples?
Well, I'm not sure it directly ties to what you're, you know, the idea that you're talking about, but it's a lot of times it is good, we just find it good to consolidate or simplify. I mean, there's a couple of examples. The original Civilization had a map that was twice as big, and it actually had a secondary tech tree where other things were happening, and We just found that by taking a lot of those things out and consolidating them, simplifying the tech tree and things like that, the game became more interesting. Because something is interesting to do once doesn't mean it's interesting to do 10 times. Yeah. And I think you have to kind of recognize that as a designer, that the player is really expecting variety, forward motion, and the game to progress and change in a way that's pretty apparent to them. So you need to make sure that if you got something that's cool, it might be cool to do it once, but it might not be cool to do it 6 times, and just kind of recognize those kinds of things. I think we're out of time. Thank you very much for coming. I appreciate being able to talk to you. Make great games!